Joining us this morning from the SOU faculty are Dr. Prakash Shingeri, and he's the chair of the philosophy department, Dr. Sherston Lyon, director of the SOU Honors College, and Dr. Justin Harmon, who teaches a variety of courses in philosophy. Well, let's start off with the new theme. SOU has a theme every year. Tell us why the college has a theme.
In 2007 and 2008, we celebrated, I think, all over the world, they celebrated the publication of Origin of Species by Charles Darwin. Mm-hmm. So at that time, a few colleagues of mine and I thought, why don't we start a series of programs, not only to inform the campus, also to celebrate the publication of the work. And we had a week-long program, and we had invited guests to speak on the biological side of it, philosophical side of it, and looking at the theory of evolution and implications for religion. And it was quite a successful event that we had. Based on the attendance that we got from the community and the campus, we thought, why don't we try a few more programs like that? So the following year, when Obama was running for office, we thought that we could discuss race. So we chose the theme of race and explored that throughout the year. And that actually kicked off the whole campus theme idea. It was very well attended. People took a lot of interest. And then the university itself was very supportive of what we were doing. The idea was many universities have where freshman students usually have a common reading that they do across campus.
Right.
But we wanted to do something different. We thought we could actually bring scholars and experts in different areas to explore a theme. So usually during the winter and spring term, we have a committee that comes together, and we talk to people on campus, we talk to people in the community, and we pick a theme. And we organize between three and four programs per term throughout the year and explore whatever theme we have chosen from a number of different perspectives. And that's the origin of the campus theme program.
And this year, your theme is identity. And talk a little bit about that and why that was selected. And that's a pretty broad word. What does it mean when you talk about identity?
Oh, yeah. So for the campus theme process, we like to select an idea or a topic that's sufficiently broad and general that it can be visited and approached from a variety of perspectives, but also definite enough that it gives us some substance to really talk about and get into. And so identity is one of those concepts that is, at this time in history, really pervasive in especially social justice contexts, political social contexts. But I think that there's an obvious place for the investigation of identity in the sciences, too, the physical natural sciences, given what we learned from Aristotle thousands of years ago, that to talk about anything, to approach any phenomenon at all, to participate in discourse, we have to know what something is, which means we have to be able to differentiate it from what it is not. And without that, all thought, all inquiry, thoughtful action is sort of foreclosed. And so I think that we can contribute a lot of different ideas and ways of navigating this kind of culturally fraught topic from really surprising angles, too.
Do you have all of the speakers and programs and everything in place, or is this something that kind of evolves organically over the course of the year?
It's both. Sometimes we do have it lined up, for example, for a term, but sometimes it evolves depending on, especially during COVID, it was very challenging to have. So we continued the same topic, same theme, for a couple of years. Justin and I just completed our first program for the year with our incoming bridge students. So we had a program, an evening, where we spent a couple of hours with them exploring this theme, and we thought it went quite well. So,
And what's something that's coming up in the near future that people might be interested in?
What is our next?
Next program we are doing it is we are working with Toya Cooper in the president's office on we are borrowing an idea that's nationally going around these days, what's called resetting the table. So we are actually taking that theme and using identity as the theme to explore, to bring people of different persuasions, political, religious, whatever it is, to sit across a table and talk about this difficult issue of identity. So that's our next program that we are working on.
That sounds good. I mean, there's such problems, it seems like, today with any kind of dialogue between people who are very different politically and religiously and in other ways. Are you optimistic that you'll be able to bring some people together and do that?
I think so. You know, I have done a couple of those programs, Resetting the Table, and that was mainly focused on political issues. And it was quite interesting to see. It is true that people come with very strong feelings, entrenched feelings about their particular political views.
Right.
But when they sit across, it's surprising to a lot of people, including the participants, that we have a lot more in common than we think.
Right.
We may disagree on certain fundamental things, and I think that's exactly what we want to do. And just to give you an idea of the kinds of things we have done in the way, you know, we've talked about the difficulty of talking across. You can take a look at the list of topics that we have done so far. Race, as we mentioned. And then we explored, which was probably one of our most successful campus themes, on being human. What does it mean to be human? So we looked at that from a number of different perspectives. And then we looked at the idea of exploring happiness. Then we looked at the idea of revolution. And last year we had disagreement. You can see the kinds of things we talk about lends itself to these kinds of multiple perspectives that Justin was alluding to.
And also I would say that commonality that Prakash mentioned provides a really nice basis for exploring those differences rather than erasing those differences to get attuned to the complexities of the issues and to walk away not in total agreement or harmony with one another, but being able to discourse about difficult issues and recognize that there are substantive sort of reasons that can be articulated for things that you previously thought to be incredibly foolish or without merit.
And so once again, let's talk a little bit about identity and what you're hoping to accomplish in terms of dialogue. And as I understand, this is not just for students, that you're encouraging the broader community to participate in this dialogue and these experiences as well.
Yeah. And I think I can speak with some degree of confidence that, you know, we can call it the tradition of the campus theme on campus. We are celebrating the 15th year this year. So we are very proud of that. So one of the things that happened when we did the Darwinian theme was the participation of the community. And both as a philosopher and an academic, for me, at one level, I would like to break down the campus community barrier because we want every child to be constantly informed, asking questions, which is what we do as citizens also. So the goal of the campus theme is to bring, you know, we bring speakers from across the country, and we have our own faculty who do that. And the goal is, as we said from the beginning, to explore this theme. In the true Socratic tradition, the goal of the dialogue, the conversations we have, is understanding what it is all about. So as part of that, we want the community to be very much a part of this. We would like the students to participate, our faculty participate, and staff. Everybody gets to participate in it. And that's the goal of the campus theme, to have a theme that the entire campus is engaged in throughout the year.
Do you have a particular way that you engage people? I suppose for folks that are out in the community, I hate to use the word marketing, but a way to reach out to them somehow and let them know that this is happening. And then, of course, students, maybe within the classes or, you know, however you communicate with students these days. I'm from the old days of a flyer on the bulletin board. I don't even know if those days exist anymore. But how do you reach out to both students and community members to get them involved?
Well, we try to do a lot of advertising on campus with flyers, posters, and so forth. And
flyers still exist.
Yeah, some old school media there. And of course, we do outreach in our individual classes, and there's also some incentivization or bribery that goes on where we encourage students to come because of some extra credit or maybe there will be some food. And we've also, in the last year in particular, ramped up our social media presence for campus theme. And I think that that's made an impact on bringing some community members to campus who previously were unaware. And so, yeah, we're approaching it from a variety of angles. But
yeah, and I think Jeffrey has been very kind enough to have, at the start of each year, Justin and I do this program. So that gives, and now people often ask what the next theme is. So it has become part of the, quite well known these days. And one of the things we also do, especially to engage students, when we bring speakers, we have them actually meet with our speakers. We organize special time for them. So there is more of an involvement, because that's one of the things we would like to have is student involvement on all this in exploring a theme, especially something like identity or revolution or any of those topics that we have discussed so far.
So when you do bring in the speakers, do they give a talk, or is it more like a panel discussion where you say, you know, people can get involved and they can give their feedback and participate?
It is all of the above. Mm-hmm. So we have, sometimes we have panels, sometimes we have individual lectures, and sometimes we have these students be engaged with a group that meets them in tabs. So we have done all of those things.
And as you look ahead, what's some of the other things that you hope to accomplish with this over the course of this year?
Well, we have some invitations out right now for some speakers, but we haven't yet nailed down the main presenters that we'd like to bring from outside of campus. But I'm not sure. What else do we have in the fall? Prakash, do you have?
In the fall, we have the resetting the table.
Right, resetting the table.
Yeah, and then for winter, we have a few faculty who have agreed to do a program. And that's when we bring a speaker, one in winter and one in spring. And hopefully they will all lead to. And one of the things I should add is that the goal of the campus theme is not to just look at one question and ask from a particular point of view. It is a multidisciplinary approach that we take. So we have, for example, one of the things we are going to talk about is identity from a genetics point of view, genetic identity. Then we are hoping to have a religious panel, group of religious people come and talk about what does identity mean in each of their religious traditions. So a comparative conversation and historically, politically, what these things mean.
We have so many people that identify in multiple ways.
That's right, exactly.
And so that must be very complex, especially you bring in students from all walks of life, and they have all these multiple identities. Mm-hmm. We all do. We all carry multiple identities. And that must be very difficult to try to sort out, I would think.
Well, that's the goal of the theme, is to explore it in all its richness. And see if we can gain an understanding. And I don't know if there's one single understanding or a variety of understanding, but the campus theme does that. It explores this theme.
Yeah, and you sort of raised one of the essential questions related to identity there. Mm-hmm. Do we have multiple identities, or do we have an identity with multiple dimensions or layers?
Well, that's interesting. That's why it's philosophy, isn't it? That almost gives me a headache thinking about that. You know, which are we? Well, and you see that sometimes. I have friends who politically are the opposite of me, yet there are certain aspects of their life that you don't think, you automatically assume that if you're this way politically, you're going to be this, that, and the other thing. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they are very different. They adhere to identities that are not typical with that particular political philosophy. And so you end up judging some people sometimes wrongly, I think, because of that.
And I think that's one of the, especially with a subject like identity, that's what happens. You know, when we define somebody a certain way or we identify in a certain way, what kinds of challenges does it pose? It doesn't have to be challenged all the time, but sometimes it does, especially when it comes to political or religious moral convictions that people strongly believe what they are.
And sometimes when we find ourselves in unfamiliar situations, we can be quite shocked about aspects of our own self that were previously kind of latent or not present. And so we start to question the extent to which we really know our own identities.
That's interesting. We have Mark here from Merlin on the line. Go ahead, Mark.
Discussion, and I appreciate that. I was a graduate from SOU in 12, and while I was there as an anthropology, archaeology person, my studies included working with the folks down in India country, Daniel West and some other the folks down there. And in fact, once I identified myself as a friend of that community, I had great results But sometimes there are negative results as far as identity as well. I identified myself just last week coming home from a public place in Grants Pass, whose name doesn't need to be known, but I identified myself as an academic, and on the way home I was mugged. I have since reported that. The police department and so on. But what I'm saying is identifying yourself and declaring your identity can have two aspects to it, some positive and some negative.
You know, that's very true. And I think about it almost seems risky anymore to identify who you are because just you're going to get an automatic reaction from some people no matter what. Mm-hmm. That it's going to be, you know, if you're in a group of people, somebody's not going to like that identity. I mean, the world has changed. I mean, I think back to when I was young, you could say who you were in terms of religion and politics and other things, and people would respectfully disagree with you and still be your friend. But today, people seem like they almost have to hide their identity to be safe, as this caller said. Do you see that as well?
Yeah. I appreciate the caller's viewpoint. I don't know, it's so much the question of whether identifying myself creates an issue. It is how you and I respond to that. I mean, I Right. think we people are free to identify in whatever way they feel comfortable within themselves. But the question is, how do I respond to that? Do I take offense at that? Do I take, you know, do I say that there is a particular way of identifying people? Or should I be willing to accept people the way they feel who they are? And I think that's part of the campus theme, is to explore these complexities of this.
You have to hear them before you can talk to them.
That's right, yeah. And I think listening is one of the things that probably we could all do a little bit more of. Yeah.
Carter is on the line from Wolf Creek. Go ahead, Carter.
Good morning, and thank you for this programming. The question of identity refers to the question of who am I, and the Advaita Vedanta tradition, particularly of South India, has been the most meaningful to me in the search for who am I personally, and it also is intimately, in my experience, related to whether I'm happy or not. If I continue in my life to refer to the question, who am I, to myself personally, it clarifies tremendously my getting up in the morning and my relationships with other people. And I want to thank you for what you've said so far, and I'm listening to comments.
Well, that's a good point that he raises. Self-introspection, you know, looking at who you are, is that something that is common today, or have we, to the point where we are identifying as X, Y, and Z in our lives, or are we at the point where we're not very good at that anymore?
Yeah. I'll take a first step and then others can join. I worry about making very broad generalizations, because generalizations have this, it's a double-edged sword. There's some truth to it. There's also something that's problematic.
Right.
So I don't know if we can make a generalized comment, but clearly the idea of identity, self-inquiry, at least in classrooms, we do it all the time. And I'd like to believe that in a philosophy classroom, Justin and I teach, that's one thing that we constantly encourage students to do. And I think that's one of those, as academics, now I'm identifying myself as one of the luxuries that we have is where in a classroom, we have the luxury of being able to do this. And we hope what we do in the classroom doesn't remain there. You know, it transcends, it goes beyond that.
And you know, certainly when, and I imagine this is still true, when I was 20 years old, I was still asking questions about who am I? And I thought I'd figured it out in my 20s, and now I'm in my 60s, and I'm back to asking that question again. So, I mean, do you see that in the classroom as well?
Yeah, it's very difficult, because this question of identity, as I think both callers in their own way have suggested, it's really two kind of questions. So first, and this is, I think, most commonly what we mean when we use the term in the contemporary world, this one's own individual sense of self or who they are. But then there's also the idea of identity by which we identify. So identification, what one is, who is the one who did X action, and so forth. And those sometimes get muddled, particularly when we're talking about, with a lack of distinction or clarity, exploring your own identity or sense of self. And so there's also the issue of the idea that we are, in our individual human identities, largely futural. And so at any given moment, you can't really come to a definite consensus or idea of who you are, because who you are is essentially constituted by these possibilities of what you might become up really until the few seconds before your death. You could even say that there's something remaining that is something still in store to be explored.
I have a friend who went through most of his life. He's roughly my age, and he suppressed his sexuality for many, many years. And, you know, that was probably a product of when he was raised. And it's no big deal to us, you know, we're close friends, but he went through a difficult time dealing with family and friends who had to accept this new identity, basically, is what it was for him. Will you be addressing some things like that in the coming year, people who have a pretty profound change in their identity, whether we're talking about sexuality or changing a religion or changing politics? I don't know if anybody changes politics anymore, but will you have some things that address that for people?
I think depending on the programs we have, I wouldn't be surprised if that came up as a topic for discussion.
But I really hope we do, because, yeah. I mean, that's really where the exciting stuff lies, I think, with respect to exploring identity. Like the sense of personal identity or selfhood, the question is how or who really am I that remains, in terms of myself or identity, that remains unchanging despite the countless superficial and otherwise changes that befall us over the course of our lifetime. And so when a profound change happens in our sense of self or in our relationships with others, I think that this kind of brings that problem to an acute kind of place.
As you're dealing with students in the class that you have, and we were talking a little bit before we went on about the challenges of a new school year and jumping off the deep end to get in, right? I'm wondering, do you see that often where this like light bulb goes on for a student, and they come to a realization of their identity? Maybe it was there, maybe it was dormant, and then suddenly, because of the experience they have in the classroom, that this just pops out all of a sudden. You must have some wonderful experiences seeing that as teachers.
Yeah, for sure. But I think as a philosopher, I'm more interested in those moments of kind of bewilderment.
The opposite direction.
Yeah, where the student comes to really decisively question or to stand in a strange relation to something that they took for granted before about themselves or about the world. So when they find themselves in a genuine condition of philosophical confusion, that's where I think that we're most successful as philosophers in the classroom.
I think I tend to agree with my colleague. I think when we get letters from time to time from students who have gone through, it is that those kinds of moments when all of a sudden something changes. It may not necessarily have to do with identity, but any of those kinds of situations which makes them think. To use a Socratic quote, what we would like to do is live the examined life. Whether we are talking about identity or any of those things, it is continually examining these things that actually is what we are hoping for in this.
They're having a moment in the classroom where they're thinking that, well, mom and dad, they were right, or mom and dad, they were wrong. Yeah. They have to go that direction. Mm-hmm. And so you encourage that in your classes, that they, for them to do you find them a little reserved? Or are students, do they tend to be very bold and brave when talking about things like identity?
Once again, it's not, it's There's no set formula for these things. Usually, initially, they might be a little shy, but as the term progresses, they become more and more comfortable dealing with these things. And if the student has taken a couple of classes with a particular professor, they're likely to be much more open and free to discuss these kinds of issues.
So far, we've been talking about identity, which is the new theme for Southern Oregon University this year. But I want to turn the attention a little bit to the Democracy Project. So we'll bring in Dr. Sherston Lyon here. Tell us a little bit about, give us the history. What is the Democracy Project?
Sure. Well, I'll call in Prakash to help out with this a little bit. The Democracy Project has been around since 2015, and it was started as an exploration of what makes American democracy the way that it is. Prakash, do you want to talk about the origins a little bit?
Yeah. So 2014 is when we, 2013 is when the Honors College inaugurated SOU. So 2014, a few of us got together and we wanted to see, explore this idea of democracy with all the challenges it has. And the goal was to see if we could do a comprehensive study of democracy, not only in the United States, but across the globe, to gain understanding of what are its strengths, what are its weaknesses, and how can we as citizens make democracy flourish, thrive better. That was the goal.
We've talked a little bit about the identity, and this seems to figure into this as well, because there are those who are, and I don't know if this is an over-exaggeration or not, but those who in America who are not so thrilled with democracy anymore, and there are others who are still very passionate about that. Your program this year, are you going to explore the subtleties of democracy?
Of course. The Democracy Project is structured in a way to take students and community members and faculty to visit where democracy is practiced around the world. And by doing that, we really build on the idea that nations are people and democracies are really made up by citizens. And that hopefully brings the idea that democracies bring together people from very different points of view. And we see examples around the world about how people negotiate those ideas and come to some sort of shared sense of governance through conversations and dialogue, very similar to what the campus theme does.
Right. And next summer, you're headed to Scandinavia, is that correct?
We are.
And is it an over-exaggeration to call them a social democracy? I've heard that term used. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean?
Well, social democracy means that the countries of the Nordic countries of Finland, Sweden, Denmark, and Norway, they have strong social programs that protect their citizens from cradle to grave. But they're also democracies and they're also capitalist countries. The really phenomenal thing that I learned by going to Norway this summer with a Fulbright program in preparation for this democracy trip, or the Democracy Project, was that Norway particularly is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, one of the happiest countries of the world, one of the most productive countries of the world, with its citizens working the least hours of any other country in the world.
Let me get my passport ready.
Yes, yes. That's what the group of us scholars all said. Where do we sign up? They have 10 months of paid parental leave. They receive, guaranteed by the government, everyone, 4 weeks of paid vacation. They have the highest levels of paid medical leave. They have the highest per capita billionaires in the world, far richer than the United States. They have the highest gender equality, the smallest wealth gap. They have some of the most highly ranked educational systems, high employment, and high levels of trust. They get a lot right. In The Economist in 2013, the headline article for The Economist was "The Next Supermodel," and it had a picture of a Viking in all of its stereotypical forms, you know, this really hairy guy that was not all that attractive with a gnarly facial expression looking like he was about ready to bludgeon something. And this was their way of playing on this idea that Nordic countries, with all our stereotypes, also really offer something incredible to the world. They're doing something really right.
What was it that made them go that direction? And again, this might be oversimplifying. In America, we like to win. Here's a winner, here's a loser. We apply it to sports, we apply it to politics, to seemingly everything in America. But some of these countries, mainly European, it seems, they have a model where they're trying to raise everybody. You know, what in their past made them like that? Do you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what I learned by being there this summer was a few things. One is that the social network was created through a democratic process by a very successful labor union movement. So labor unions organized, they went through the democratic process, and they're a part of the process of negotiating how the country is run. Multiple parties also are part of this, but also a culture of austerity, being very conservative with what you have. A country like Norway doesn't have a lot of resources. They have to rely on fish and not a lot of warm days for growing things. And growing up in that kind of a cultural environment led the country to be more careful with its resources. So when oil was discovered off the coast of Norway on Christmas Day, actually, of 1969, they did not fall into some of the traps that other countries that became instantly oil-rich did. They saved their money. They only ever used 4% of the proceeds from the oil. And that has led them to be one of the wealthiest countries in the world with a very sustainable oil fund, to continue to support the country far into the future.
Now, I have a question. You have run the Democracy Project for a while now. Where are some other places that you've visited and looked at different kinds of democracies?
Prakash, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So in 2014, our first trip was to Washington, D.C. So we spent about a week there. And, I say this with some hesitancy. Our students were rather disappointed because in many of the places that we went to, even the State Department, you know, which represents the United States across the globe, we rarely talked about democracies. So students said, you know, what is it? We are the world's most powerful democracy, and yet we don't talk much about that. So when we asked the students, where do you want to go next? They wanted to go to places where actually democracy was not only thriving, but they wanted to learn more about that. So the next trip we made was to India. That was a very successful trip. And every place, we had the same format when we visit these countries. We meet with politicians, academics, journalists, we visit government offices and have a conversation with them. So we had a very successful meeting in India where we talked to politicians, we met the Supreme Court of the High Court in one of my states, and students had a very interesting exchange there. So they were very surprised at how much there was a passion for what democracy was all about. So we came back, then we went to Europe, four different countries, Austria, Germany, the Czech Republic, Then we came back, then we went to South Africa. And we came back and went back to Italy and Greece. One of the things that we do, which I think I would like to mention, is each time we have gone on a trip, we have come back, we organize a symposium for our high school students, led by our students who participate in it. So as a result, we go and learn about democracies in those countries, but we also come and share what we have learned. And that's quite an enlightening experience, not only for the students, but also our students who participate. They take the lead on these things.
So. Now, is this program just for your honors students, or can other people participate in this if they want to?
Absolutely. Other people can participate. We've had community members travel with us, students from other universities travel with us, staff, faculty. This is quite an inclusive kind of experience. And in fact, if anyone listening to this this program would like to learn more, we're having an information meeting tomorrow evening at 5:30 p.m. in the Suzanne Holmes Hall in the Fishbowl area of the Honors College. Anybody who would like to can come and hear more about the project and more about the trip that we're planning for next summer.
What do you have the students do to prepare for this trip? I'm assuming they're doing some stuff, looking into Scandinavia and all of that. What do you have them doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Prakash, do you want to talk about what you've done in the past?
Yeah, one of the things we do is, for example, I have already started corresponding with the embassies of these countries in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. to get material. So we inform the students, all the participants, about their constitution, a little bit about their history. And Kirsten, she had just come back from Norway, so we will be talking to them about that, how their government works, some of their policies, their relationship with other countries, so the students have some basic background into how those democracies work and contrast it our own. So when we actually go there, they actually get to see how their democracies are being practiced and to some extent promoted.
And for community members, how can they, besides maybe going on the trip to Scandinavia, which sounds wonderful, by the way, how can they be involved over the course of this coming year? Are there things that they can do?
Absolutely. We're going to have some open sessions where we're going to talk about different themes that will come up during the trip that anybody who would like to participate can come and participate in. We'll have similar kinds of events throughout the year, in the evenings, open to the public, on campus, where we can talk about the different parts of democracy for the Nordic countries, their happiness model, their cradle-to-grave welfare plan, how people in Nordic countries argue that this actually makes them more free. It makes them more able to be entrepreneurs and start businesses, which is really one of those things that is counterintuitive to Americans that tend to think that any kind of taxation and social welfare program limits choices. But from Nordic perspectives, it actually increases freedom far beyond what Americans enjoy. And so we'll talk about some of these conflicting ideas about what democracy and freedom mean, really thinking about it from the perspective of Nordic countries.
It's interesting to me sometimes when I host for Jeffrey and fill in, and I have conversations earlier in the show and then later. In the first half hour at 8 o'clock, we were talking about the Inflation Reduction Act and how that has such an impact on potential drug prices, especially for seniors on Medicare, but for everybody in general. And one of the ideas we talked upon just briefly was the idea of freedom. You know, if the prices come down, that means for certain people, you have a greater deal of freedom because you have more money in your pocket. You're paying less for drugs. And so it kind of like it fits in, you know, when you're looking at that that Scandinavian model where they do have, again, an unfortunate word maybe, but socialized medicine, where they do have this cradle to grave, as you mentioned. It must open up the freedom, not having to worry about that, and then to go, you know, forward and do whatever, whether it's becoming an entrepreneur or whatever happens.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, imagine if you knew that certain things were guaranteed, that your health insurance was not something that you had to worry about, that your pension was not something you had to worry about. Imagine the kind of freedom you would have to make different choices. One of the speakers that we heard this summer when I was with the Fulbright program was somebody who had come to the United States and did a lot of research. And he said he talked to a lot of people who said they weren't really happy with their jobs, but they couldn't leave because they couldn't lose the insurance.
Right.
And think about the freedom you could have to start a new business if you didn't have to wonder where your insurance was going to come from or your pension was going to come from. You have a lot more freedom to make choices and to make different choices, maybe to move occupations, maybe to move jobs, maybe to leave even a relationship that you might not be benefiting from, where you might be getting your insurance from,
right.
Or kids from their parents. As soon as kids are 18 in Nordic countries, they're very free to make their own choices. They don't have to rely on their parents' insurance, and they don't have to rely on their parents' economic information to go to school, because higher education and different vocational training programs are all free and supported. So they have more choices and they have more freedoms.
And it makes me think a little bit about identity that we were talking about earlier. I'm sure, of course, in Scandinavian countries, there are people who don't like that. They have they'd like to maybe scrap it and go to a more of a right-wing kind of conservative American model. So that must be part of the whole democratic process as well.
Sure. Sweden just voted in a very far-right Swedish Democratic Party.
That's right.
Yep.
Well, that's it for today's exchange. We have been speaking with Dr. Prakash Shingeri, Chair of the Philosophy Department, Dr. Sherston Lyon, Director of the SOU Honors College, and Dr. Justin Harmon, who teaches in the Philosophy Department. We've talked about the new theme for the year and the Democracy Project. To the three of you, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.